Welcome to the Barth Calderone Wealth Protector Podcast. Our founder, Harry Barth, and his son, Brad, are top speakers on asset protection and estate planning to many incredible groups across the country, including the Women Presidents Organization, Vistage, the Young Presidents Organization, the California Apartment Association, and many more. And now, here is your host, Paul Hitchcock.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Wealth Protector TV. This is Paul Hitchcock, and I'm really excited to have my two guests on today, Amanda Hahn, who's a managing director with Keystone CPA, and Brian Chow, who's a partner with the firm Barth Calderone LLP. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us, Paul.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. And Amanda, we're going to start with you. We're just going to jump right into this. This is really for property owners. There's going to be a lot of lessons here for everyone in general, but your expertise is dealing with investment property owners. Amanda, what is going on today? What are some of the hot button issues that property owners should be thinking about when it comes to your area?
Gosh, hot button issue in terms of right now, we've been looking at the 2023 budget proposal from President Biden. And not surprisingly, some of the recurring issues or proposals we've seen in the past are sort of back on the chopping block. I think two major ones that property owners should be looking out for are the proposal to increase capital gains tax rates up to close to 45% for high income earners, and also the potential elimination or limitation of 1031 exchange. So 1031 exchange meaning our ability to sell a property, be able to defer the capital gains taxes until we buy new replacement properties. Similar to last year and 2 years ago, the same topics seem to keep coming up in the budget proposals. I think, you know, no one has the magic eight ball to see what the future holds. But if I had to guess, I probably think that none of these will be passed. But nonetheless, those are some hot button issues that our firm is keeping an eye on.
Yeah, it has it happen, Amanda. When they come out with these proposals, now what is the process? They're going to debate on them, and there's a lot of them in there. What should property owners expect? I mean, is there anything going to pass, or what's different this time?
I don't know that there's anything different. I think from what I was reading about it, the odds of this passing are pretty much close to zero, just kind of because of the political climate. So, we're just kind of keeping our investor clients informed on what the proposals are, but really no significant or, you know, really meaningful action at this point in time. I think we're just kind of on a wait and see. But, you know, in terms of the possible limitations of 1031 exchange or maybe capital gains taxes going up, if you're someone who has a pretty significant portfolio, one thing that we've been talking to clients about is taking a look at what are some of the properties that you might sell, right? If there are ones that you want to sell and get them reinvested into better market areas or better asset classes within real estate, you kind of want to be ready to move if some of these changes were to become more of a reality in the near future.
Okay.
You know, and if I were to jump in, Paul, I mean, yeah. I would say I agree with Amanda in that given the current state of Congress, the likelihood of any sort of an action of this of these budget proposals is again pretty close to zero. But I think what one takeaway is for the audience at large is that this is essentially the vision or the wish list of what the Democratic Party would like to get enacted, right? So it's one of those things where if the Democrats do get control of Congress again and the presidency, then these are things that are likely going to be things that they're going to try to enact, right? So, so it may not be something that needs to be that clients need to take action on with the assumption that's going to happen today or tomorrow, but really more understanding that, hey, if we do see, the results of the next election, if it veers back Democratic, then these are some things that we should expect to come back up as realistic things that we want to plan for.
Well, that's a great take on it. Amanda, when you're dealing with your property owner clients, aside from this budget proposal here, spending proposal, what are you counseling investment property owners on that they should need to be aware of, or what are best practices or things you're talking about outside of something like this proposal?
Yeah, I mean, for investors, we work with investors all the way from, very new investors to people doing very large syndications. So kind of just across the whole spectrum. Mm-hmm. But I think regardless of the size of your portfolio, one important thing for investors to keep in mind is that real estate itself is considered a business in the eyes of the IRS. And so when you hear people talk about tax benefits for business owners, when it comes to write-offs and things like that, it's really important for investors to understand that they get most of those same tax benefits. Wow. And so what happens is, we'll see investors who will say like, hey, I got a couple of rental properties. I'm going to write off my mortgage interest and property taxes and maybe management fees. But what a lot of investors forget to write off are a lot of these overhead real estate expenses. So whether it's traveling to real estate conferences or buying books about real estate or different subscriptions, those are things that are very important for investors to make sure they're tracking and deducting, because I think that's probably one of the most common mistakes we see, that investors not really treating the rental properties as a business and capturing all of those related deductions. And I think I'm going to switch this over to Brian, because one of the most common mistakes that I hear from investors all the time is, I own my rental property in my personal name, therefore I cannot take any tax deductions. So there's this confusion about legal entities and tax write-offs and just people being confused about, the interaction between the two.
Yeah, that's great. Brian, you want to comment on that? Because this gets into the legal entity and ownership. How does that work? LLCs, your own name, all of that.
Sure. Yeah. So thanks for teeing that up for me, guys. I would say that my experience as an asset protection and estate planning attorney is probably very much similar to what Amanda was saying. Is a lot of times you come across, or I'd say the majority of the times we come across real estate investor clients, is right, it's more often than not they're holding title in their own name, or they might be holding title in their living trust, which might be better in the sense that it means that they've given some thought to their planning, but maybe not fully fleshed it out, right? And so when we're talking about real estate investment, one of the things that we really look at for our clients is, how do they insulate themselves from the liability of the rental properties and vice versa? Because it is a business, right? And businesses come with risks, right? And so if you have a tenant slip and fall on the property, if one of your business partners sues you, right, et cetera, there's liability that can attach to your other assets, or there's liability that can come to you individually and attach to your rental properties.
And yeah, because Ryan, you've mentioned before the inside and the outside liability. I've heard you talk about that, which is what you're referencing, right?
Right. Yeah. So liability can flow in a couple different ways. And I think a big part of, our initial client interactions is really, one, getting a sense of what they have, and number two, starting to educate them on where the risks are in their situation, right? Whether it's succession risk, right? You die, all your assets go to probate and it becomes a huge mess, and your loved ones, your kids don't talk to each other for decades after the fact because you haven't done the proper planning, right? Right. Or it could be the mitigation of the risks associated, right, that are floating around on your balance sheet, either flowing through you to your assets. Let's say you get into a car accident, somebody sues you, right? They're suing you personally and now trying to come after all your assets. Or the other one, which is usually maybe a little higher up on most real estate investors' radar, which is, hey, what if something goes wrong with the property? Again, one of my tenants or one of their invitees or a contractor gets hurt on the property, and now they're trying to come after all my assets, right? And so an important thing for clients to know is, if you hold assets directly in your name, right, that liability from your property comes straight to you and can now attach to all your other assets, right? So if you have multiple rental properties, all of those are fair game, perhaps your house, perhaps your investment accounts, and the various other assets that you worked hard for your lifetime, the default is those assets are generally exposed, right? And then the other way would be, again, you get sued personally, right? Somebody's trying to come after you. That also can attach to the various assets that you have. And so how do we knowing the way that that liability can flow across the balance sheet, how do we construct these firewalls between our assets and liabilities to make it more difficult for creditors to reach those assets so that we have more leverage to reach settlements for less money, less time, and less headache?
Yeah, I remember you just reminded me of a case that came through the firm, the mold claim, and you know, long-term tenant, and there was a mold, and the landlord fought it, lost, and it was a $1.8 million liability. The landlord insurance fought him to not cover it, but that's what you're talking about. A claim like that that goes out of control could attack everything else that landlord owns.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So yeah. $1.8 million judgment, right? Then that judgment is generally enforceable, right? If it's held in the landlord's name directly, or even if it's held in the landlord's living trust, for example, right? Those assets, there's no asset protection as a result of either of those titlings. So making sure or making clients aware of that and then helping them to build in structures that make sense given their risk tolerance and their budget, that's a big part of what we do from an asset protection standpoint.
So. Well, this is an interesting question I have for both of you, because I know as you're getting into talking about the legal entities, how do the two of you work together? Let's say you had the same client, and Brian, you're giving input on, hey, these are the proper legal entities to own your property in. Amanda, are there tax issues that differ between you own it in an LLC? Maybe it's a single member LLC. Maybe it's a multi-member LLC. Is there a tax difference there? And then versus your living trust, your name, joint tenancy. I mean, how do you two do that? Is there conflict?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I wouldn't use the term conflict, but I think sometimes a little bit of competing interest, right? So whereas if Brian might say, okay, we need, you know, for the best asset protection, we might structure it one way. And then my job is to come in and look at kind of the cost of it. What is it going to cost in terms of fees, whether it's on the entity side or filing tax returns, and the complexity of it, you know, how many set of QuickBooks do we need? How is the client comfortable with the complexity of how money flows? And what's really great about a whole team of advisors approach is that I think when Brian and I work together, then we are bringing that proposal or the suggestion, right, the strategies to the client to let them know what we think might be the best. It's always ultimately the client that makes the decision. But you're right, a lot of those things you just talked about, you know, who should own the entities, how should that entity file tax returns? There's a preference in terms of I would like to do it. Maybe that'll save the client more money in terms of how they file. But before I recommend that, I always want to kind of check with Brian too, like, does that kind of minimize the asset protection side, right, of this particular client? Or are we kind of on the same page in terms of how that works? And I think, you know, for investors especially, I think for a lot of times it's difficult for them to be the middle person or the translator, where they talk to their CPA who gives some advice, and then they talk to the attorney who gives a different advice, and they're trying to kind of translate what happened. And again, so this is where that team of advisor approach is so important, because the client is the decision maker, but they're not having to go in between. And we can kind of have that conversation as advisors ourselves to then come up with what the strategy could be.
So Do you mind if
I jump in real quick too? Yeah, I would say that, there is sometimes inherent conflict when you're dealing with attorney to CPA or vice versa. I would say between Amanda and myself, or between advisors that kind of have the philosophy of coordinating with other advisors and talking to one another to make sure that we encounter different perspectives and take input in order to craft what's in the best interest of the client, that tends to be the best result, right? And so in the past, you know, I've encountered other CPAs where they'll look at everything solely from a tax perspective as opposed to a legal perspective, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are plenty of attorneys that look at things solely from a legal perspective rather than a tax perspective. And so what's awesome about Amanda is that she is very knowledgeable about asset protection as well and how it interrelates with the tax field. And so we, you know, very often have mutual clients that we're advising on. And yeah, she'll ping me or I'll ping her and say, hey, you know, tax-wise, you know, we're thinking about doing this, but would you, you know, would you prefer that this LLC be taxed as a as an S corporation rather than a disregarded entity or as a partnership, right? And then she'll chime in and say, okay, based on this particular individual's tax situation, probably makes more sense for it to be, for the management company to be an S corp rather than a disregarded entity, right? And so so that's really great. And we can, again, be more valuable to the client because we're interacting with one another and the client doesn't need to be the middle person. And so I would say, yes, there is some inherent conflict that pops up, but when the advisors willingly talk to and coordinate with one another, I think it just creates way better synergies and way better results for the client. So,
yeah, because I would say that, you know, with a common thread that is woven through many business owners, whether it's property or not, is everybody knows an advisor, right? Everyone knows, you know, people know attorneys, CPAs, insurance, you know, folks, on and on. Very few times those people are coordinated. And the common thread is that in the planning, there's holes in the planning, or they don't do the planning because it becomes so confusing to understand what to do because no one's talking to each other. And the way you two just laid it out seems to me to create a lot of efficiency, you know, where there's sort of your quarterback guiding the client, which is great. I want to ask this this question. So both of you have competition. Brian, there's LegalZoom. Amanda, there's TurboTax. But the reason I bring that up is because, Brian, people can bang out an LLC on LegalZoom, you know, in 10 minutes, right? So, and, you know, how do you respond to why you better set up the LLC properly? Because it's, you know, it's going to matter if something happens to you. What is it about the LLC that people better make sure they do it right?
Sure. So this is a common misperception. And even it was one that I even had before I really got into asset protection planning, which is, you can bang out an LLC in 10 minutes. Why pay an attorney to do it? Right. And so, and what I've learned having done this for over a decade is that LLCs are not difficult to set up. It's not difficult to plug your name in on a website and your social security number and press enter and send it in. But what can get very complicated is the structure of your asset protection, right? And so there's a number of variables that go into it. First of all, what is your situation? What are you trying to protect? Are you trying to protect yourself from the liability of the property? Are you trying to protect the property from your liability? How many properties should go into one LLC, right? Are these hotels each worth several millions of dollars, or are they, you know, five single family, properties in West Texas each worth 30 grand of equity and kicking off, you know, $200 of cash flow a year, right? What should the LLCs be, right? Should they be venued in California? Should they be venued in Wyoming? Where is the property located, right? Do we need to do any foreign registrations? What is the tax structure of that LLC? Is that LLC going to be held in something else, like a living trust, an asset protection trust, a holding company, right? How should those be taxed? What should actually go in it, right? So a lot of it is the architectural work, right? So if you're going to build a house, you kind of want plans that say, hey, this is how we're going to do this. And then you actually want the plan to get executed, right? A lot of times clients will just say, yeah, I'm going to bang out a California LLC because I live in California. It's easy. I plug my name in, LegalZoom, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. And then all of a sudden we look at it 3 years later. One, the properties aren't even in California. So it's not even, right? It's not duly registered to do business in the state that it's supposed to be. Maybe the properties never even got into that LLC. They never drafted the deeds, right? Or filed them or recorded them. And maybe that LLC, maybe it's just held in their name. So if they die, well, what happens, right? Those assets are now all in probate as well, right? And so there's a whole host of variables, right, that go into it. And that's not even talking about the internal management of the LLC, right? Who are the partners, right? Is your second cousin going to be owning it? Is your wife going to be owning it? Are we going to trigger a reassessment if we transfer properties into or out of the LLC? So there are a ton of variables.
A lot, yeah.
And generally speaking, I do say LegalZoom serves a purpose. If you can't afford qualified help, and this is the best thing that's available to you, great, right? It's better than nothing. But if you can afford qualified help and you have assets to lose and, right, assets to protect, then you're almost certainly better off hiring a qualified professional to assist you.
Yeah.
Not only the design, but also the implementation of the plan.
So. Oh, that's great input. And Amanda, I you know perfectly well TurboTax is not your competition at the level you are, and you're working with people, but it kind of it begs the question in my head is, what do you first do with potential clients when they come on board? I know you have a very tight onboarding process. I've seen it. It's incredible. But do you go through any sort of a upfront analysis to determine if you even want to work with them, but then of what is involved? How do you onboard?
Yeah. So I mean, I think you're right. You know, TurboTax is kind of like DIY entity formation, right? The software is only as good as the input. And so for an investor who doesn't really understand taxes, you're answering questions, but you don't really understand what the questions are. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I've seen pretty catastrophic results because believe it or not, you know, TurboTax made me do it is not a valid excuse if you're audited and there are penalties, right? We've seen that excuse, attempt to be used. In terms of our onboarding process, so what's really interesting about our firm is in the past couple of years, we really focused our specialty to be on the tax planning side. What we realized is that there are a lot of CPAs out there. You could probably find a dozen, in any given block that will do tax return filings. But really, what's been difficult for a lot of investors and business owners to find are CPAs that provide tax planning services. Planning meaning consultation during the year before you enter into transactions to figure out what are the best ways to do those transactions. Before I buy a property, right? What kind of entity? How should I purchase it? Before I sell a property, should I 1031 exchange? What are some other offset strategies? Or even, changing residency, right? Moving out of California, what's a good way to time all that so I can pay the least amount of tax? And so what we've done is we've shifted our focus to really focus on the planning side of it. Mm-hmm. So when we onboard new clients, it's really taking a holistic look at their personal, their business, their investments, and then figuring out kind of what they did, where they are, and where they plan to go, and then creating a plan based on those facts and where they plan to be financially in the next couple of years.
Love it. Love it. And Brian, as we hit the ceiling here, I'm going to ask you the same question. I know you have a very tight onboarding process too. You'll have an upfront discussion and understand the issues. Is that a fair way to couch it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that my onboarding is similar to Amanda's in the sense that, and I tell my clients or prospective clients this, right? Usually when I'm meeting with a prospective client for the first time, we will set a complimentary meeting, either face-to-face or by Zoom, depending on their preference. And it usually consists of three parts. And the way that I describe it to a prospective client is this. The first part is I want to get to know you, right? So I want to know who you are as a person, family situation, finances, assets, so that when I'm advising you, I have a holistic understanding of your situation. I'm just not winging it and making things up, right?
Right, right.
Another important thing that I tell clients is I want to make sure that you get an opportunity to get to know me too, because if this is done well, it's not a one-time transaction, right? This is going to be, if we do it well, this is going to be a long-term relationship, one that may span decades, right? So better for us to do the work up front to make sure that we're a good fit to work with one another, not only today, but into the future. And I've had clients say, look, I'm not really looking for a relationship. And I'll say, okay, well, I'm probably not the right attorney for you, right? And, and that's fine too. And that's a good thing too, right? If that's not what they're looking for. And so the second part of the meeting then is educational. So spending a little bit of time talking about whether it's estate planning or asset protection or whatever the client's reaching out to me for. I like to spend a little bit of time just talking about the basics, because clients will come to me intuitively with some understanding that they need to do something, right? But they don't necessarily understand how everything works. So I like to just spend a little bit of time just kind of educating them and giving them a feel of the legal landscape. And then the third part of the meeting is then turning the spotlight back on their situation and talking specifically about their goals, their vision, and then figuring out where to go from there. And so depending on what their interest is, it can branch off in a number of different paths, but in a nutshell, that's typically what the first meeting looks like.
Love it. Great information, both of you. Yeah, I want to thank everybody that's listening to this. Thanks for showing up. And both Brian and Amanda's information is around this video, wherever you're watching it, because we stream everywhere. Amanda, Brian, thanks so much. Great information. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay.